Okay, let me go ahead and talk. This is going to be, it's the afternoon, so I'll let this be somewhat informal. I'd like to talk a little bit about the work that we did actually a number of years ago in modeling how protein sequences change. A lot of mutational models, let's see where I could get my head out of the way. A lot of mutational models are the generic mutational models or substitutional models involve assumptions that each location is changing identically and independently. And of course, both of those assumptions are wrong. There have been a number of talks by a number of people, David Pollack, who else, Bill Atchley, and things like that, in terms of breaking down the independence part. The part that we've been looking at is not looking at the independence part per se, but looking at the identical part. How do you include the fact that different locations in the protein are different, and how do you put in a model that takes that into account? There's a little talk about that in terms of this gamma distribution and rate variation or whatever. What we're doing is rather different. So I've never, there, page down is. Okay. So most previous work in terms of phylogenetic analysis and the work that a lot of the work that's taken place in the workshop has been looking at evolution on the DNA level. There are a lot of advantages to looking at the DNA level. For one thing, there's lots and lots of data. You know, there's a lot more DNA than amino acids. There are also fewer substitutions possible. So the most general model you can possibly come up with has 12 different rates of every base going to every other possible base. So it means that the number of parameters in these models can be much lower than with amino acid models. And one of the other things is that we assume that a lot of the selective pressure that exists on the genome takes place at the protein level, and then, which means that non-coding regions of the DNA in general are not under this selective pressure. Or, for instance, the selective pressure that Paul talked about this morning in terms of base pairing, again, that's something that could be rather easily encoded into a rather simple model. So the advantage is that we don't need to consider complicated forms of selective pressure. One of the disadvantages is that, especially for non-coding regions of the DNA, the changes are occurring at a pretty good clip, which means that if we look back at a decently long period of evolutionary time, an A in one sequence is equally likely to be any base in the other amino acid, which means that everything gets lost in this haze of history, where we're not able to look at deep branching events. And there's a lot of interest, again, as Paul mentioned this morning, in terms of looking at these deep events. The other thing is that the thing that makes these models so much simpler in terms of not having to consider the selective pressure is a disadvantage if what we're really interested in are the things that are existing under selective pressure. So there's a lot of information about how proteins change and such that tells us something about the selective pressure that these proteins are under, and we lose that if we do not deal with it directly. So our interest was looking at the protein level with the idea that the selective pressure would change the rate, would slow down the rate of change, allowing us to look deeper in evolutionary time. And the idea is that it would tell us something about the proteins that are doing the evolving. The disadvantage is that it's a much more complicated system. Selective pressure is a rather multi-headed beast, and so we're going to have to include some type of complicated scheme for thinking about selective pressure in ways that are not clear beforehand. And so what I'm going to be talking about is ways that we are trying to address this question of building complicated models of the substitution process in amino acids as simply as possible. Okay. So the basic idea, there are a few slides here that were made for a somewhat different audience, so I've tried to take most of them out, but there still may be some slides that people may find a little bit insulting to their intelligence. The basic idea is that if we're interested in modeling in interpreting evolutionary change, everyone, with the exception of Arnold Kluge tomorrow, would say that we would need a model in order to represent how these sequences change. And so that's generally of the form of a substitution matrix, a 20 by 20 matrix, where this is just color-coded in terms of what's the probability that one amino acid will change to another amino acid over any period of evolutionary time. Okay, so where do we get these substitution models from? Generally, what happens is we have a set of sequences, aligned sequences, and each location in the set of aligned sequences would correspond to an evolutionary tree like this, where we imagine the mouse and the rat, the ancestor of the mouse had a leucine, and the raboon of the ancestor of the mole had an isoleucine. So in this model here, we could just simply count how many of each transition we had. We had one I to L transition, one L to I. We could figure out how many examples of each we had, what is the probability that one transferred to the other. And we could do what Terry always says we should try to do, which is try to actually calculate and compute the rate of substitution of all these characters. But the real problem is this, okay? that we have what's called the missing data problem, where we don't know what these ancestral sequences are.
So it was given by God, but now we make believe we don't know it.
We don't know it at all. So the idea is that we're trying to find the.
It had something in there.
Oh, right.
Nail on the rock.
Right. So I'm saying if we had that data, it would just be counting. But since we don't have that data, independent of mosquitoes trapped in amber, and then we're going to have to do something else. So the way we've done it, and I approach this from a Bayesian point of view, is to basically say we're interested in finding the model that maximizes the likelihood or the log likelihood, just the probability that the data would occur if the model were correct. This is a rather easy thing to calculate. So what you could do is you could just imagine one scenario of an I changing to an L and an I, these changing to an I, L, I, I. And the probability of that particular path is just the probability that you would start with an I times the probability of all of these substitutions that occur in the path. So by summing over all possible identities of these three nodes there, summing over all values of x, y, and z, we're able to compute probability of the data given the model, making no assumptions at all about the particular scenario that resulted in our current day sequences. And by the way, the reason I said before that this computation goes as the alphabet size cubed, the way it works is you calculate what's the probability of things ancestral to this node for all 20 values of this node. You calculate the probability of all things ancestral to this node for all 20 values of that node. And then that allows you to calculate this by calculating the probability of going to this times the probability that whatever this is would generate everything underneath it, and that is a 20 by 20 by 20 operation, or the alphabet size cubed. So you just work your way up the tree, and since the number of these internal nodes is equal to the number of species minus one, it means that the calculation is linear in the number of species and goes as the alphabet size cubed. Okay, so that's the correct part that everyone rediscovers, but I think it was Felsenstein who did it first. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, so what we do is we have our model here, which has the 380 adjustable substitution rates, and we throw in the sequence data into the top of this. We have our box which computes the log likelihood, and what we do is we vary the 380 elements in this matrix in order to maximize the log likelihood. 380 as being the general non-reversible model of any amino acid going to any of the other 19 amino acids. So it's 20 by 19.
Can we choose 2, which is 390?
Let's see. It would be 4. Well, one way of looking at it is it's 20 by 20 minus the main diagonal, because the probability. Okay, so it would be 400 minus 20. Oh, right. So it would be 20 choose 2. Okay.
It's 2. It could be 20 times 19
is 380.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so as I said, one of the assumptions in these models, the JTT model, the PAM model, the Blossom model, whatever you want to, is that there's a single matrix which describes the rate of substitution of one side for another. And it says, I don't care whether this where this threonine is, I don't care whether it's an active side or an outside or inside or a helix or coil, whatever. I am, if I'm interested in what's the probability of that threonine becoming a serine, I look it up in my 20 by 20 table. Okay? And obviously this is a really bad assumption because the rates of these various amino acids represent two processes, a mutation rate, what's the probability of a change in the DNA level, times the fixation rate. The fixation rate is the probability that this mutational change will become fixed in the sample, will become the consensus sequence. And the fixation rate depends upon how good or bad the substitution is. So if I have a substitution that's extremely inappropriate for this particular location in the protein, then I would expect the probability of fixation of that particular change would be rather low. On the other hand, if I make a change here, which is a new change, and this is makes this protein super protein or whatever, then the chances of fixation of that version would be higher. And obviously, the selective pressure depends upon what that part of the protein is doing. So this one-size-fits-all model for all locations in the protein is a rather bad assumption to make for proteins. What we would ideally like is a separate substitution matrix for every location in the protein. And so we could imagine that since every location is in its own unique environment, what we would like to do is to have our own 20 by 20 matrix describing the position 85 in cytochrome C or whatever, which means that we would have to adjust 380 adjustable parameters for every location in the protein. That would be 380 times n adjustable parameters, which obviously we're not going to do. That would be massive over-parameterization of the database. So what are we going to do? We can't do this, so let's try to back off a bit and see what we can do to try to get some of the grosser features of this site heterogeneity in a practical model. Well, one thing that we've done and other people have done, including Tom Blundell and Nick Goldman and such, is to imagine that there's a different rule for different types of structures. So what we could imagine is having one substitution matrix for alpha helices, another substitution matrix for beta sheets, another substitution matrix for turns and coils. This is actually a very easy thing to do, because what you could do is you could divide up the database, so you have a database of only sheet regions, and calculate your substitution matrix for those sheet regions. Or you could imagine cutting up the protein however you think would be the best way of cutting it up. And as I said, these are our two matrices here. Red means a large number, light blue means a small number. These are actually the matrices for coil regions in the protein that are exposed to solvent, and another one for helical regions in the proteins that are buried in the protein anterior. So for instance, here the gap problem we dealt with by the gap by just calling it a 21st amino acid, you could see that there's a large probability of amino acids changing to a gap, which would correspond to deletion on this exposed coil, while it's much smaller on the buried helix. There's other things like, for instance, that hydrophobic residues on the outside are more likely to change to a gap, while in the buried part, it's actually the hydrophils that are more likely to change to a gap and such. So what we could do is we can generate these substitution matrices that are specific for different locations in the protein. And we had a lot of fun with this. How about exposed turns and buried coils and such? We even did different substitution matrices for thermophiles and mesophiles. We were interested in trying to figure out what was responsible for the stability of thermophiles. Could we figure that out by looking at the changes of selective pressure in thermostable proteins versus mesophilic proteins? So what we did was we actually prepared mirror data sets of proteins, mirror data sets of proteins, where we would have the same proteins, one set from thermophiles and one set, actually mostly extreme thermophiles, and another identical set from mesophiles. And what we would do then is we would, we didn't break it down by secondary structure, but we did break it down by exposed or buried locations for the same set of proteins and try to ask what the biggest differences are. This was at the stage when people were trying to figure out what is the magic bullet which gives these proteins their thermostability, and our result was consistent with what everyone else found. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this. You know.
Identical now?
Oh, this is a cartoon. Okay, so I could actually show you the slide, but it's way, way too big. If you notice, there aren't even 20 columns here. Okay, so it's like Mickey Mouse with three fingers.
One of the previous slides, you showed this thing because
it was
highly asymmetric.
Wait, what?
It was
highly asymmetric. Highly asymmetric, right.
So there is your triangle now, so you're fine.
Excuse me?
Does it mean that there is a metaphor of something to the something?
Actually not. By the way, these are also cartoons. This is real data here. Okay, so this... What?
A little warning sign on the audience is trying to pick it apart.
You're not imbibed.
Right, right. So two things. One is that this is the probability that a serine would become a threonine, which is not the probability that a threonine would become a serine. So the fact that it's asymmetric makes sense. You would expect for it to be stationary, not that it would be symmetric, but rather that the relative rates would depend upon the relative populations of the two objects. So when we constructed these matrices, these were actually based upon rooted trees, and we did not assume stationarity. We did not assume detailed balance or whatever. And then after the fact, we asked, do these things obey detailed balance? And the answer is more or less. Okay, so these matrices actually are relatively good about detailed balance, even though that was not put in as an assumption. Okay. So are these models adequate? You know, why were we unhappy with these models? One of the things about these models is it still says that every location in an exposed location in an alpha helix has the same substitution rates. Okay, and again, that's sweeping a whole lot of variation, a whole lot of heterogeneity under the rug. It ignores the complex nature of structural constraints. Just as an example, alpha helices have typical capping residues on the end, which are necessary for the fact that, I don't know if people remember from alpha helices, that is based upon hydrogen bond patterns. The hydrogen bond patterns go out into the next residue along. What happens when you hit the end? You have to have some type of capping residues with side chains that are able to hydrogen bond to the backbone residues. So that gives special structural constraints that are not the same for all locations in the alpha helix. Ignores functional constraints, catalytic residues, dimerization sites, etc. It ignores any other type of selective pressure except the pressure on some alpha helix to remain an alpha helix. And what is an alpha helix anyway? What is a beta sheet anyway? These are the patterns that are the most obvious to crystallographers. So crystallographers look at a protein and they say, turn it around and say, oh, this looks like an alpha helix. Oh, this looks like a beta sheet. So it's not necessarily true that the structural designations which we think are important or that crystallographers think are important are actually the most appropriate designations to use. And finally, when we were doing this work, we were interested in studying the HIV envelope proteins, a protein with a lot of side heterogeneity into it. They have hypervariable and regions and such. But the structure wasn't known. So how in the world are we going to model structure based upon structural specific substitution rates when we don't have a structure to decide what the appropriate substitution is? So what we moved to was an idea that you could have what we called site classes, that you could imagine that there are different site classes in the protein, each with its own substitution matrix. So we could imagine, for instance, that the purple sites map to one substitution matrix, the green sites map to another, the yellow to another. On the other hand, we don't say that we know what locations map to which site classes. So what we want to do is we want to be able to pull from the data understanding of which locations in the proteins seem to be under similar selective pressure, and a corresponding model for those particular locations without a prior designation of which locations map together, group together for a particular model.
You don't mean these classes have to be continuous?
Not at all. So the idea is that we could imagine that every location in the protein could be defined as existing in one of these, in this example, five different psi classes, where there's just an a priori probability for any location to be involved in one of these psi classes. Okay? So the things that compose our model are the a priori probabilities corresponding to the probability that any given location would be in any one of the psi classes, plus the given substitution matrices corresponding to each of these psi classes. Each of the psi classes, yeah, corresponds to a 20 by 20 matrix. Yeah, not 12 by 12 as in this cartoon. Okay. And so we could calculate the probability of the data given the model in the exact same way that we did before. All we do is we calculate the probability of the data given the substitution matrix corresponding to psi class K, multiply it by the a priori probability that you really are in psi class K, and add over all possible psi classes, where the probability of the data given that you're in psi class K is the exact same formula when we had a single psi class. Okay, so this is basically what we ended up calling hidden states model, where the psi class of each location is hidden. That's a hidden information. But we have a model which says what's the probability of a given substitution given the identity of the psi class at that location, which is unknown. We would typically go up to about 9 or 10 or whatever. Okay. Okay. So, I think Terry's getting at the problem with this, that if we have 10 psi classes, as an example, each psi class has 380 adjustable parameters. That's 3,800 various substitution rates. There are 10 a priori probabilities. We know that the a priori probabilities have to sum to 1. Okay, so that leaves us with 3,809 adjustable parameters, which is way, way more adjustable parameters than we can deal with in any reasonable model, or computational time or whatever.
But those 9 probabilities of being in that matrix could be a different 9 for each amino acid.
So the idea is in the model that we do not know a priori which location belongs in which psi class. So we assume that these are global parameters, that each location in the protein has the same set of a priori probabilities of existing belonging to any one of the various models.
The probability of a proline belonging in a psi class corresponding to a helix is a lot different than if it's...
And you're exactly right, that what we can then do is, given the data, we could calculate the posterior probability that says, so the priors say, before I look at the data, what's the probability that this location is in any one of the psi classes? And that number is the same for all locations in the protein. We can then calculate the posteriori probability, which is, given the data and the priors, what is the probability that that location is in one of the various psi classes? And in that case, it will depend upon the location of the protein, and I'll actually show that a little bit later. Okay. So the problem is that we don't have the computers nor the data to deal with adjusting 3809 substitution rates in a model, especially since there's not only heterogeneity between various locations in a protein, there's also heterogeneity between different proteins. So we were interested in doing this model for specific proteins, as I said, the HIV-1 envelope protein. So it meant that we were already dealing with a rather limited data set. So how do we adjust, deal with this explosion in the number of adjustable parameters given the size of the data that we have to work with and the size of the computers that we have available for us? Okay. So we need a simpler substitution model with many fewer adjustable parameters that try to capture some of the biological motivation. Let me just mention, as Bill actually talked about last week, we were also interested in trying to interpret these in terms of what is this telling us about the protein. And so we wanted the model to not only be simpler with fewer adjustable parameters, but for us to be able to look at the models that came out and say, ah, yes, of course, that's what's going on. Okay. So how do we do that? Well, in bioinformatics, generally people consider alphabets. So they say, okay, what's the probability of a vertical line with two horizontal lines changing to two vertical lines with two diagonal lines meeting at the bottom? Okay? What's the probability of a letter F changing to a letter M? If you're a protein, though, you don't care about that we call one a methionine and one a phenylalanine. What you're really interested in is what's the probability that if I had something like this in this location, that I would tolerate a substitution for something like this. So if the protein, as far as the protein is concerned, it's interested in what's the rate of a substitution of amino acid with the properties of phenylalanine by an amino acid with the properties of methionine. Okay, so one of the things we could do is instead of putting our substitution matrix in terms of the amino acid identities, we could try to put it in terms of the properties of these amino acids. Okay, so how do we go about doing this? Step one, represent the amino acids by their physicochemical properties. We tried a whole bunch of different properties. The things that we found that worked the best, and this is exactly what Bill actually found and talked about last week, was the hydrophobicity in bulk. So Harold Chiraga did a normal, where you principal component analysis of all these different amino acid indices and found 10 that seemed to encompass the largest amount of variation from one amino acid property to another. One corresponds to hydrophobicity and another corresponds to bulk. The bulk defines leucine as a zero. The hydrophobicity, I don't know what that defines as a zero. So rather than thinking in terms of a cysteine, we say, no, it's not a cysteine, it's an amino acid with a hydrophobicity of minus 1.05 and a bulk of minus 0.89. What?
Size.
Volume. Yeah. Step two, we would say that there's a certain natural fitness of any amino acid in any location in the protein. And it's a function of the properties of that amino acids, but the function is unknown. So let's imagine, for instance, that this, I'll call it the fitness of amino acid A sub I inside class K was, for instance, a linear function of its hydrophobicity and size, or quadratic function of its hydrophobicity or size, some simple linear function of the physicochemical properties of these amino acids. Okay? So what this allows me to do, because I know what the hydrophobicity and bulk of all 20 amino acids are, it allows me to specify 20 fitnesses for all 20 amino acids with something like 2 to 4 adjustable parameters. Two to four adjustable but unknown parameters. Okay. Three. Oh, so here's just an example. If I have a fitness function that's just linear with hydrophobicity in bulk. A little small thing like alanine has a very poor fitness, while something nice and large like an arginine would be very fit in that particular location. What? So there's a particular alpha for every K, but it's unknown, currently unknown. Okay? Then I imagine that there's a probability of finding in a given amino acid at site class K would be represented by a Boltzmann function of the fitness. Because fitness is good, just like energy is bad, there's a positive sign here rather than a negative sign. So it just says that given the fitnesses, the probability of one amino acid or another is an exponential distribution. This isn't an assumption. I could imagine this as defining the fitness here. So I haven't said what the fitness is, but I could imagine defining the fitness as the log of the probability that a given amino acid would be found in that location at equilibrium. Okay. And so in the example before, if this is the fitness of these amino acids, I could calculate this and calculate before. Alanine was not very fit in that location, so the probability of seeing an alanine there is very small compared with the probability of seeing an arginine. Okay. So right now with two to four adjustable parameters, I have a model which describes the fitness of all 20 amino acids for of any particular side class, as well as the probability of finding any amino acid in the location described by that side class. I still have to do kinetics. I still have to figure out what's the probability of changing from one amino acid to another, what's the probability of changing from an amino acid with one fitness to an amino acid with another fitness. Okay. So how do I do that? Well, let's think about what we want. One thing is it makes life easier if things are reversible. So let's try to make things reversible if possible. And as I said, our previous experience showed that when we omitted reversibility, it didn't really change things very much. Let's imagine that the equilibrium distribution is given by this. Okay, so the second constraint is we want an equilibrium distribution given by this relationship here. And our third assumption is based upon the idea of neutral evolution. Okay. So there's a battle, I mentioned this a couple of months ago, between people who favor the idea of neutral evolution versus adaptive evolution. According to adaptive evolution, there are bad mutations and good mutations. The good mutations are accepted, the bad mutations are rejected. According to the neutral theory, the vast majority are either neutral or bad. So that if I make a neutral mutation, it's accepted with some probability, about 1 over 2n, where n is the effective size of the population. And if it's bad, it has less of a chance of being accepted. So let's assume this neutral model that we have some type of attempt rate. And then we assume that if it's not bad, it will be accepted at a constant rate, that there's some fixed probability of acceptance of that mutation. Let's then assume that if it's a bad mutation, so that the fitness is actually going down, there's less of a chance of that change being accepted. So we're modeling things as either being neutral or bad. Okay.
Mm-hmm. How do you determine the scale of
fitness? The scale of fitness? Again, these coefficients here are at this stage completely unknown. Okay.
So you at some point you are going to.
I'm going to define them. Right. So given those three assumptions of reversibility, of an equilibrium distribution matching this distribution here, and where I have all positive mutations accepted at constant rate and negative mutations accepted at a lower rate, there's only one type of kinetic scheme which will fulfill those three requirements. And that is the Metropolis kinetics. Okay. So basically, the idea in Metropolis kinetics is the probability of one mutation, one amino acid changing to another, is given by an attempt rate, nu, times either one if it's an increase in fitness, that's where the neutral assumption comes in, or an exponentially decreasing probability if I'm resulting in a net decrease in fitness. And so the fact that this is reversible that won't surprise anyone. The fact that it gives the equilibrium distribution of an exponential distribution is not going to surprise anyone. And it's the only possible model which fulfills my three assumptions. Okay. As a result, cartoon again, you're able to completely define this 20 by 20 substitution matrix with something like 3 to 5 adjustable parameters. Okay. So I have my attempt rate, and I have my 2 to 4 adjustable parameters that tell me how to look up the physicochemical properties of the amino acids and translate that to a fitness. And that's all that I need to calculate all of the entries in my 20 by 20 matrix. Okay. And so how do we adjust all these parameters? We do the exact same thing that we did before. What we do is we now have all of our adjustable parameters, all of the attempt rates, all of the prior probabilities, and all of the coefficients describing the relationship between amino acid property and fitness. And we throw in our sequence, and we twiddle these knobs again until we maximize the log likelihood given this model. So for instance, if we did this model where we had 9 different psi classes, 6 with quadratic fitness functions, 3 with linear fitness functions, the total number of adjustable parameters with this model of 9 different psi classes was 47 adjustable parameters, close to an order of magnitude fewer adjustable parameters than a single standard substitution matrix. Okay, so for instance, we had 9 psi classes. Each of the quadratic psi classes has 4 adjustable parameters. Each of the linear psi classes has 2 adjustable parameters. So that's this number and this number. These are the 9 attempt rates, and these are the 9 priors. Okay.
So what's the difference between quadratic and linear? Why should some psi
class work? So linear would be those examples of some locations where some sites want a residue as small as possible, or as large as possible, or as hydrophobic as possible, or as hydrophilic as possible. Well, quadratic would deal with those cases where there was an optimal size, or hydrophobicity, or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do you have 9
or 10
rates?
What?
Why do you have 9
or 10 rates? 9 or 10? Oh, right. So ideally, you would argue that if the model were correct, we would want to have one given. It's basically to a bit of a fudge factor into the fact that we're ignoring, for instance, codon frequencies and codon structure and all of this. We're ignoring a whole bunch of other things in this, so that there's anything that happens at the DNA level. I think that this model is model of the Boltzmann distribution and such, and the Metropolis kinetics is itself not not exactly the right model. So by having these variable rate amounts, it allows us to incorporate some of the other things that are not incorporated explicitly into the model. But I could argue that that the better model we build, one thing that would be good to see is that the distribution of these rates would go down to a single number. Mm-hmm. Okay, so so I mentioned that the old way of doing things is to have a traditional substitution matrix where all rates can vary independently, 380 adjustable parameters if it's not doesn't obey detailed balance. It would be, what, 190 plus 20, 210 if I assumed that it did obey detailed balance, but it ignores site heterogeneity, but it's not so reductionist in terms of how it views amino acids. Then I've described our own work in terms of these simple physical chemical based models, which only depend upon the bulk and hydrophobicity of the amino acid. It doesn't care that proline has causes kinks and things. It doesn't know about disulfide bonds. And it's based upon these, as I said, the Boltzmann distribution is not an assumption, it's a definition, but it's based upon this bizarre idea of Metropolis kinetics. So the question is, how can we figure out which of these models actually fits the data better? You know, as if you're interested in statistical tests, you could imagine doing, you know, chi-square distributions or whatever, and people like Pohl would yell and scream and say, no, these are not nested models, you can't do that. So the question is, how are we going to get valid statistical way of evaluating how these two models work compared with each other? So we've been working in sort of protein structure prediction for a while, and so we thought we would use the same approach that protein structure prediction people have been doing for a long time. The basic idea in this is to say, let's have two separate sets of data. Let's have a training set, let's have a test set. Let's adjust all of the parameters on the training set, and then let's see how well they do for describing the transitions that we occur that we see occurring in the test set. So as a result, when we're comparing various models with the test set, all of the models have zero adjustable parameters. Okay, so at least, you know, the number of adjustable parameters is fixed. It's zero always for the test sets because we're not allowing any of the rates to change once they've been set for the training set. Okay. The only thing is, where can we get this training set and this test set? We're interested in developing models for specific types of proteins, so we're not interested in generic proteins. We're interested in modeling a particular type of protein. So what we would like to do is to have two identical proteins whose histories are completely disjoint, yet are under presumably similar selective pressure, evolutionary pressure. So what we did was we decided to use the envelope proteins from HIV and HIV1 and HIV2. The idea is that HIV1 and HIV2 are distinct from each other. The substitution rates are independent for these two models, but the envelope proteins have similar structure and such, so we would expect that to first order, the selective pressure on both of these envelope proteins would be somewhat similar. So this graph here, what I'm doing is I'm showing the number of adjustable parameters for the various models on the x-axis. This gives the log likelihood scores on the y-axis. This is actually with an offset. So this is the log likelihood minus the log likelihood that you would observe with equal substitutions of old types. But that's just a constant, you know, just to make these numbers somewhat more reasonable. And so if we use, for instance, a Dayhoff matrix is assumes reversibility. So it has half as many parameters about as a regular 380 element matrix. And we get a certain log likelihood.
Right.
Oh, so this is when we optimized for HIV1 envelope protein and tested on HIV1 envelope protein. Okay. So that was actually looking up Dayhoff matrix, typing it in, and using it here. There's no optimization at all in the parameters here, right? Okay, and that's my first point. Okay, here I've taken a traditional 380 element matrix and optimized it specifically for my HIV1 envelope proteins. Sorry. Optimized for a general set of proteins. Okay, so this is where I had a generic database of proteins, and I used this log likelihood formulation to say what is the best 380 element matrix optimized for my generic set of proteins. Not really. What we did then was we then took a 380 element parameter model and optimized it for HIV1 envelope proteins. So here, this is the best that it's possible to do with a non-symmetric or symmetric single substitution matrix acting on the entire protein. And because, again, these do not assume detailed balance, they're about twice the size of the Dayhoff matrix.
Sorry, I was forgetting what you take a group of HIV
proteins? Right, a group of HIV1 envelope proteins.
And then you allow these matrices to vary and you do something with gaps
also? We're varying out all locations with gaps. We threw out all locations with gaps, yeah. So we're only looking at non-gap locations.
In the Dayhoff case, you adjust the
branch length? Right, so we adjust the branch lengths. Okay, but nothing more than adjusting the... We also assume that the topology is fixed. So this is just taking the Dayhoff, adjusting the branch lengths. Traditional matrix optimized on a large variety of proteins. Traditional matrix optimized for HIV1 envelope proteins.
Can I maybe estimate how much of likelihood I gain by introducing one more parameter, probably a factor of two, or if I choose the parameter from the mean,
so,
then it will probably
two parameters
I get
logarithm
of likelihood two.
Um, yeah. Um, so, um, but. For instance, this has 380 adjustable parameters, but it's optimized on a database that's a broad database, not just HIV-1. Here, in this, it has the same number of adjustable parameters, but I've exactly optimized it for the model that for exactly the HIV-1 envelope proteins. But let me push one more button, okay? Let me just...
HIV-2 you were going to test.
No, so this is the first slide.
Oh.
That's the next slide.
But I don't know what the 500 sort of unit difference in log absolute mean when you compare different models.
You're right that it's difficult to determine in this particular case when things are not nested, okay? Which is why we want to go to an independent. Let me go to the next slide. Okay. Let me just mention that these simple models tended to have, as I said, something like up to 49 adjustable parameters, but we actually got a log likelihood increase of about 226. So the idea is that we would expect more complicated models with more adjustable parameters to represent the data better, and the question is, does it represent it better enough given the extra number of parameters that you've added? What we've actually done is we've decreased the number of parameters by about an order of magnitude, and we're getting a log likelihood increase of about 226, which is a substantial increase. Remember, this is log of the likelihood, so in terms of likelihood scores, that's much higher. But the real test of this is what I mentioned on the test set. You know, that what we wanted to do was to say that if we adjusted the parameters on the HIV-1, how well would it work on HIV-2? When we're at, for the HIV-2, all of these models become zero adjustable parameter models. And in this case, we actually do much better on this model than we did on the HIV-1. What's happening is that the fact that we have many fewer adjustable parameters makes these models actually less prone to overparameterization, less prone to memorization than a standard 380 element matrix. So as I said, this is all with a test set distinct from the training set, and we're getting, and these are all zero parameter models when operating on the test set, and we're getting an increase of about 800 log likelihood scores.
Suddenly realize I don't know what you're calculating.
Whoops. Okay.
Are you calculating the structure, the distances?
No, what we're doing, so the log likelihoods is the probability of the data given the model.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you testing?
So the question is, at this stage, we have different models representing these processes. For the test set, since we've already fixed and carved the parameters in stone, all of these are zero parameter models. So what we're interested in doing is trying to ask the question, can we develop, are these models working better than traditional matrices? So the question is, if these models are working better, we would assume that...
My question is simpler. Exactly what are you testing? I mean, you're testing the model.
Right.
What are you calculating? What are you comparing?
So what we're calculating, you mean what's the y-axis here?
Yeah.
Oh,
y-axis of log of likelihood of what?
So what we have is we have a lined set of HIV-2 envelope proteins. We have a putative phylogenetic tree for these sequences. We are then using these models to calculate what's the probability that these data would result if the model were correct. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same logic that you just bring HIV-1 to HIV-2. I would call the Dayhoff and the traditional matrix optimized for general protein zero parameter models because
right.
They were optimized on different data sets. And in fact, traditional matrix optimized for HIV-1, the traditional matrix optimized for general protein is nested within that, right? Because what you've done is you specified all those parameters in the green model, right?
Yeah.
And the optimized for HIV-1, there were all three parameters, so
right.
You could have gotten exactly that model, but instead you've allowed them all to breed, so that they are, in fact, nested models.
These are, in fact, I would say they were nested in this, I'd say they were nested here, in terms of the fact that you, because here, when I'm adjusting for HIV-1, I am adjusting these parameters here. Right, but are they, I don't know if they're nested for in this case over here because of the fact that this is a model with 380 fixed parameters. What?
Yeah, here they're set.
Here they're set, yeah, yeah.
So they're all zero.
They're all zero parameter models, except the branch lengths.
I'm missing something conceptually. It's still worried about putting different models on the same.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I have a model that all these things are generated by 120 amino acids, and then the likelihood is one, I mean, it's the highest you can be. Something simple I'm missing.
So you're arguing why are these numbers so high, or?
No. What does it mean with like a different model you're comparing?
So what I have is I have a fixed data set
of the HIV.
I have a fixed data set of the HIV.
You're saying you're comparing. Okay, this model explaining this data set.
Right. Exactly.
But explaining sort of which.
In terms of that, if I okay, the way I so I mean I approach this from a sort of a Bayesian view in terms of the fact that I have a number of adjustable models, and by the basis for believing one model or another is based upon how well it represents the data, represented by what's the probability that that data would result if the model were correct. Okay, so it's with given a fixed data set. And so I can't assume that all the locations are conserved because that's not the data.
Okay, well, maybe if I divided the vertical axis all by 1,000, would it make a difference?
If you subtracted 1,000, it wouldn't. But you can't divide by 1,000. What? Because this. Yeah, it's a log of a probability. The what? Okay, I would be changing the base of my log if I divide my numbers. But then you would have to interpret those based upon the. Okay, so in other words, it's a log of a probability that the data would result. So and so what I've done is I've actually offset these values by a null model, but that doesn't. Really affect anything. It's really the difference of log likelihoods I'm interested in. So since the difference is the thing I'm interested in, that's why I could subtract numbers and add numbers, but not divide them.
You've got a bunch of simple models. You've got like 3 side classes.
I think it's 1, 3, 5, 7, 8, 9, or something like that. So it's a number of different side classes. So if I have one side class model, all it means is that I am back to an extremely simplistic, reduced form of this model. So the fact that it doesn't do better is not surprising. It's interesting that in this model, I have to have about 7 different side classes before I do better than a traditional model. But that when I'm actually going to testing, then I do better as long as even with 3, with even some simple incorporation of side heterogeneity.
In this model, there's only 2 kind of physical eigenvectors in
the Yeah.
Yeah,
we played around with all sorts of things. What we would do, for instance, is I have a good paper that I could give you. But what we did was we, for instance, divided things up and allowed there to be functions of all the 10 Chiraga parameters, and we could see that the parameters that were important would actually vary according to where you were in the protein. So, for instance. And we get all sorts of bizarre things. Like if you were a buried alpha helix, the parameter that really matters is the tendency to be beta sheet. That there was a real conservation of a propensity to be beta sheet in buried alpha helices. Okay, and the explanation of that, I believe, is that that beta sheets are generally buried. And alpha helices are often more on the surface. So what has been interpreted as a tendency towards a beta sheet is really just a tendency to be buried. And it's true of Alpha Helices as well. But we had all sorts of fun and games in terms of calculating this. Or for instance, you were asking about our new value, this rate there. Turns out if you look on the outside of the proteins or on the inside, you can notice that there are various different types of locations so that, for instance, on the outside, you tend to get two different types of sites, those that are quickly varying that prefer hydrophilic residues, and a slower varying population that prefer hydrophobes. Well, on the inside, it's the other way around. You know, so there's all sorts of... the new factor, the attempt rate, the attempt rate.
Yeah, that's what I thought,
that
new is the mutation rate.
Right.
What you said about beta sheets is true, but there are a kind of protein with only beta sheets. Then they would, some of them would almost have the properties like alpha.
So it means that the parameters that characterized beta sheets was not a strong beta helix tendency, where beta helix tendency is the factor that people looking at the database have characterized as a beta sheet tendency. So this thing that people have identified as a beta sheet tendency, we found more expressed in the conservation rules for buried alpha helices and buried beta sheets. Okay, and it turns out in secondary structure prediction, or structure prediction in general, the thing that is really, really difficult to get are the buried beta sheets. Okay.
Have you tried an even simpler model, taking the bulk out?
Yeah.
Does that do quite well?
We've tried various combinations of various things. So one of the things that we've done, for instance, is we assumed that there were, for instance, 10 psi classes, only depending upon bulk, where quadratic with quadratic dependence, which means there was an optimal size, and we had optimal sizes evenly spaced, and we let the amplitudes vary, you know, and we looked at only exterior locations or interior locations or whatever. What we tried to do is we tried to say, given this model, what is the distribution of propensities of amino acids of various size in locations? It turns out that every location in the protein likes small residues. Okay, which is not surprising, again, because of the fact that there's this entropic loss on folding, and so there's less of an entropic loss if you have a small residue with less flexibility in the side chain. So we were able to pick out these things based upon the proteins. Some like small residues very, very much, others just like them a bit, but there's a general tendency, for instance, for that. Mm-hmm.
Can you train your model on a different
I don't think so. I think that we would.
Paralogs.
What?
You get paralogs.
You mean the HIV-1 and the HIV-2?
And so other paralogs might be suitable as long as they retain the same.
Yeah. The HIV, the envelope protein is special just because it's an example specifically where we were attracted to it because common models do not do well, just because there are these antigenic sites and all these other things. There are some regions of the proteins that vary very rapidly and others that vary quite slowly. So we were we particularly chose a model where these other models broke down. We did try it with Rev and pole genes for HIV, and we found that we did a little bit better with one and really miserably with the other. Which is not surprising because the selective pressure that they're under is very different from the envelope proteins.
Did you align the posterior probabilities of these two proteins, HIV-1 and HIV-2?
No, we didn't actually. That would be interesting. That would be interesting. Yeah, that would be interesting to do. What we've let me just get to that a bit, and maybe I'll let's talk about it in two slides, okay? And this is your basic the thing that you asked before. We have identical a priori probabilities at any location in the protein would exist in any one of these psi classes prior to actually looking at any of the data. But you can actually calculate the posterior probabilities, the probability that any location is in a given psi class K, given the data at that location, just what's the probability the data would be derived given that particular model normalized by the possibility of all possible models. This is a different, and so what we could do is we could use this to identify what locations of the protein are under similar selective pressure or distinctive selective pressure. And this is frustrating because we, for reasons of comparison, we did this on a protein that was a then unknown structure, because what we'd really like to do is just map this on a structure. But this gives the posterior probabilities that we're in psi class 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5 in this particular model. So the yellow locations are those that are most likely or pretty definitely in psi class 1. The blues are in psi class 2 and such. And so as you can see, this is a very non-random pattern. So what we're doing is we are picking up some type of information in terms of the correlation that you tend to get blocks of locations under, of contiguous blocks of locations under similar selective pressure in various parts of the proteins. It's I think a set of all mitochondrial proteins, but this was applied to one particular mitochondrial protein. What? I know, and I don't remember which mitochondrial protein it is. I could look it up. I think there's all of the
residues after throwing out the ones with gaps and all.
Right. I could tell you, if the people who know mitochondria, pretty much all of the proteins are going one direction except for one protein which goes the other direction. This is the protein that's going the other direction. Okay.
It's a small. And is it crystallized?
I'm not quite sure whether the, is the structure available? No. Yeah, so what we're doing this, we're now doing this for G protein coupled receptors, of which we do have a crystal structure. You know, so,
for the HIV, you don't have a crystal structure?
We do have an envelope protein structure now. We just haven't gone back and mapped it to that particular structure.
Correlate, obviously. The color tell you whether it's G, Q.
Yeah. What?
It's like you may not even need the class form.
But the thing about it is, if you're interested in functional, that those may be locations of specific functional characteristics. And so often the ones that are extremely distinctive are the ones that we might be most interested in from a structural biology point of view, although they may be the least, phylogenetically informative. Okay. What we would do is, if there is a completely conserved site, then, and that was a significant fraction of the proteins, then we would expect there to be one psi class with an extremely low attempt rate. But what we're doing now is we're playing around with just setting one particular psi class to conserved, and with new set identically equal to zero.
Right now, these site classes are abstract. It has nothing to do with space.
Right, but what we could do is, right now we're doing these on proteins of known structure. The nice thing about G protein coupled receptors is that a lot is known about them, but not so much that that we can't maybe find interesting things out about them using this type of analysis.
So when you start to optimize, you don't tell the algorithm anything about what the categories should be. Is that right?
No.
So it's slightly difficult to understand how it knows what things in categories. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you can get the same, you always get the same categories if you try and repeat.
As long as we have, that's one of the reasons we went only up to about 9 psi classes, was above that we started to get like results. What we've done is we've instituted an EM algorithm, which I think will be a little bit more robust to these things. By the way, it's one of these examples where MCMC would be a total disaster, because if the search space is really ergodic, all of the identities of all of the nodes will all be switching around on you, and the average will be just, you know, a flat distribution. So, but EM, we're hoping, will give us some interesting results.
Do you have
I could look it up. We typically do things on the order of 30, 40 sequences. Okay, that's been sort of our standard in terms of dealing with these things. What we do is we do sort of like David with his highly accurate phylogenetic tree. What we do is we just throw the sequences at a standard software. I think we use ClustalW or whatever, neighbor joining pattern, to get some type of alignment with the idea that that way there's no biasing of our results towards things that would be helpful or not helpful. So we don't. And one of the nice things about throwing out locations with gaps is that those are the locations where the not only does no one know how to deal with gaps, but they're also the locations that are most suspect in terms of alignments. So we even sometimes chop out regions of the proteins where the alignments are uncertain and only deal with the regions that are somewhat more certain. Okay, so we're doing phylogenetic reconstruction, reconstructing ancient proteins. You talked about that a bit. In the computer, in silico, not anything else. Understanding the effect of structure, function, environment on the selective pressure. We're trying to use these to develop new methods for homology identification. The basic idea is that we may be able to try, that if we have a model which models the heterogeneity of selective pressure, it may be that two proteins will have no sequence similarity, but if they are homologs or analogs even of each other, they may be under similar patterns of selective pressure. And so the idea is, can we identify similarities in the patterns of selective pressure and use that for identifying homologies? And this is the work. It was all started by Jeff Koshy and is being continued by Matt Dimmick and Sarah Ingalls. That's Ting Lan. Okay. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.